guiding intervention. Now, the Arab strength was concentrated primarily in much greater firepower. They also had air forces at their disposal. Now, at the beginning of the war, the Jewish community had nothing comparable. The Jewish most important resource was found in the dedication and military experience of their troops. The dedication and military experience of the Jewish people was the number one resource they had, although I guess I shouldn't say that. The number one resource that they had was the Lord, because the Lord definitely brought about the survival of the state of Israel at this point in time. A man named Yigal Yadin was Israel's commander of operations. On May 14th, Jewish manpower resources were critically limited, and so was the supply of weapons. On May 16th, an attack came from Syria. On May 16th, a Syrian column of 200 armored vehicles, including 45 tanks, moved toward the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. Its target was the cluster of prosperous Jewish settlements on both sides of the Jordan River. Several of these were overrun. The column then proceeded to attack Degania, the oldest kibbutz in Israel. And without any kind of artillery, the Jewish forces were helpless to block the Syrian advance. Until then, the only heavy weapons that had been unloaded at Haifa were four howitzers. They were the type used by the French army in 1870 during the Franco-Prussian War. These things were almost 100 years old. So two of these ancient field pieces were promptly dismantled and rushed to Degania. The local commander was Lieutenant Colonel Moshe Dayan. He had them reassembled, and they were ready to go the very moment the first Syrian tanks rumbled through the kibbutz perimeter. They fired off these little howitzers, and they scored a hit on the advance tank, the very first tank. Now, the Syrians didn't know that these two obsolete weapons represented half the arsenal of Jewish field guns in Israel. They didn't realize that. They didn't know that. If they knew that, they might have pressed the attack. Instead, they were terrified. The armored vehicles swung around on their tracks and clattered back up the mountain road, and they never returned. That is more than just coincidence. That is the hand of God. The Iraqis proved only slightly more effective than the Syrians. Their contingent was stationed in Transjordan near the frontier. It numbered 8,000. 3,500 were combat troops. They made an effort to launch an attack across the Jordan River opposite Baisan on the day the mandate ended, but it failed. Now, the most critical battle areas of the war proved to be in the south, along the Egyptian line of invasion, along the south, up the coast, and into the Judean hills. Now, there in the Judean hills, the Arab Legion laid siege to Jerusalem. Now, the Brigadier General Mohammed Naguib commanded the 2nd Egyptian Brigade. Naguib commanded 5,000 troops, and he proceeded cautiously up the coastal road toward Tel Aviv, going from Egypt up the Gaza Strip, up the coastal road toward Tel Aviv. And the Egyptians encountered unexpectedly stiff resistance from a little isolated kibbutz known as Yad Mordechai. Yad Mordechai withstood 5 days of intensive Egyptian shelling before being evacuated. Those 5 days tied up approximately half of Naguib's coastal force and mauled one of his battalions so thoroughly that it had to be temporarily deactivated. Several miles away, another kibbutz, Negba, was blocking the Egyptian advance with equally ferocious resistance. The Egyptians eventually decided to skirt the farm community, and Negba remained a continual flank threat on the flank. It was bristling with arms. They decided to go around it. The Egyptian, Naguib, moved with elaborate caution, and he slowed his drive 16 miles from the outskirts of Tel Aviv. And it was at this time that Yadin decided to risk a tactical offensive. On May 29th, He ordered reinforcements from the Jerusalem corridor to circle Naguib's positions at night and to attack the Egyptians from the rear. With its troop strength of barely half of that of the invaders, the relief force nevertheless found darkness and surprise very, very effective. The Egyptians were thrown into confusion by the unexpected descent upon their flank. Now, Yadin exploited the disarray by calling a press conference and announcing that the Egyptian supply lines had been cut by overwhelming concentrations of Israeli troops. Now, this news, quote-unquote, this news was immediately dispatched over international wire services and eventually reached Cairo. Yadin had hoped that the Egyptian High Command would accept the story at face value, and they did. They accepted this story at face value. They radioed Naguib to pull up short, and the bewildered commander dutifully followed orders. Naguib's setback proved to be the turning point of the Egyptian invasion. Tel Aviv was never in jeopardy again. The Jewish situation in Jerusalem was very, very serious and precarious. The Jerusalem area was besieged by Transjordan's Arab Legion. The Arabs controlled every high place, every height around the city and within the city. Their fighting strength by then was nearly 4,500 armed men. While the Jewish community, they were numerically equal, but were without weapons. We were virtually without weapons. And so the battle for Jerusalem commenced. On May 19th, Abdullah sent his first units into the old city. Simultaneously, an additional 2,000 legionaries, well equipped with artillery, and also commanded by British officers, moved on Jerusalem from the north and soon besieged the outlying perimeter. After 10 days of savage fighting, the outnumbered Jewish troops finally managed to drive the legion back to the point of its furthest advance at Mea Shearim. On May 28th, the British commander, Sir John Glubb, decided to call off the attack in the northern part of the city. Some of his companies had lost as much as half their effective strength, and others were unnerved by the shattering blast of homemade Jewish mortars. And from that point on, the Arabs switched their offensive to Jerusalem's southern approaches. On May 2nd, under cover of a heavy Transjordanian artillery bombardment, Egyptian infantrymen stormed the kibbutz of Ramat Rachel, lying astride the entrance to southern Jerusalem. What followed was the single most furious encounter, most furious battle of the war. The little kibbutz changed hands 5 times during the next 4 days. Soldiers pressing forward in bayonet attack often had to climb over bodies piled one on top of the other. But when the last attack was over, it was the Jewish community, most of them former Irgun, most of them former Etzel members, who were in control. And for that moment at least, the imminent possibility of the Arabs capturing the new city had faded. However, the Jewish quarter of the city failed to hold out. On May 28th, the Jewish quarter surrendered. News of the fall of the old city was received with profound shock in the Yishuv. That meant the loss of the Western Wall and also the loss of the Temple Mount. So the loss of those two very important sites was lamented with bitterness in the years to come. So the Arabs thus far had been unable to conquer the urban complex through direct assault. By the opening of June, however, the ability of the metropolitan area to hold out was far from certain. The prospect of mass starvation was very real. Ben-Gurion insisted that full military priority be given to opening the Jerusalem highway. Remember, this is one of those key highways that had been cut by the Arab forces. Yigdal Alon was called down from the north on May 23rd to assume strategic responsibility for the assault on Latrun. Latrun was an Arab strong point controlling the road. New recruits were needed to augment the Jewish forces. And so hundreds of recent immigrants possessing no military experience, no military training, not even basic training, were rushed up by bus and taxi from Tel Aviv. On May 25th, under the command of Colonel Shlomo Shamir, the attack was launched in a blistering desert calm scene. Blistering desert heat wave. There was no adequate reconnaissance, there was no adequate artillery support, and the soldiers were thrown into a direct frontal offensive. The Arab Legion's 4th Regiment, ensconced on the village heights, raked the attackers with mortars and artillery, and the Jewish soldiers were thrown back with heavy loss of life. During the next few days, additional efforts were mounted, but each time the result was the same. Latrun very nearly became the graveyard of Jewish hopes for breaking the siege of Jerusalem. A single alternative remained for opening up a Jewish supply line. Now, during the previous weeks, Colonel David Marcus, an American Jewish volunteer and West Point graduate, was serving as area commander for the road. He'd been using a path south of Latrun, south of the town of Deir Ayub, to infiltrate troops on foot through the hills of Jerusalem. The Deir Ayub section of the road is also known as the Bab al-Wad. Now, Marcus speculated that the path that he used, the path might be widened, just wide enough to enable vehicles to pass through. Those vehicles then could carry supplies and break the siege of Jerusalem. He broached this idea to Yadin, and with Yadin's approval, hundreds of laborers were now summoned from Tel Aviv and immediately put to work clearing boulders and dynamiting rock sidings. Their work was named the Burma Road. There was no opportunity for rest, even in the fiercest heat, for the United Nations truce was to come into effect on June 11th. If the Burma Road was not completed before then, no further efforts would be permitted after the truce deadline, and the result would be that Jerusalem would starve. On June 9th, a primitive roadbed was cut through the Jerusalem mountains, and the first trucks loaded with cans of food and water ventured out on the makeshift highway. And several hours later, they entered Jerusalem, and they were greeted to an enthusiastic and rapturous Jewish population. They just beat the deadline. And now the first United Nations truce is going to go into effect. The idea of a truce in the fighting was introduced and endorsed by the UN Security Council on May 20th. There was a mediator chosen, Count Folke Bernadotte of Sweden. This chosen mediator arrived in Israel the following week. Later, he was assassinated by the Sterngane. The Sterngane was suspected of the assassination. This was the same group that assassinated Lord Moyne. Now, the Arabs were generally receptive to the idea of a truce. All fighting was designed to stop on June 11th. So this truce descended on the exhausted armies, quote, as dew from heaven, in the words of one Israeli commander. Both sides were at the limit of their resources. Now, strategically, the Arabs had gained very, very little. The Syrians had established a bridgehead on Israeli territory, but it was a minimal one. The Arab Legion from Transjordan had taken the old city, but that was of questionable military importance. The Egyptians had acquired a toehold in the Negev, but that was just a barren desert. Whatever pretense of a united command that had ever existed among the Arab armies had simply disintegrated with the actual fighting, and the Arab armies were in disarray. Abdullah, the Hashemite king of Transjordan, lost interest in continuing the war. However, the other Arab leaders made effective use of the truce. The Iraqis increased their numbers at the front up to 10,000, and they added large quantities of equipment. The Syrians also carried out an extensive recruiting campaign, as well as the Egyptians. By the first week of July, the number of Arab regular troops in Israel had grown from 32,000 to some 45,000. Gravely short of manpower and weapons, the fledgling Israeli army actually was in danger of collapse on nearly every front. By the truce provisions, neither side was permitted to introduce new reinforcement, new troops to their armies. Under the truce provisions, Jerusalem would be allowed enough food and water for a month, but nothing more. But the Israeli high command had no intention of abiding by these conditions. Abiding by these conditions was considered suicidal. So convoys of food and medicines were rushed to Jerusalem. Mobilization was continued and increased dramatically in early July. The little armaments factory in the land moved into full production, turning out bullets, grenades, and mortar shells. Weapons were secretly unloaded at coastal sites. By then, the quantity of guns and equipment had become substantial. On May 20th, the Czechoslovakian government turned over an entire military airfield to the Jews. In the following months, this became Israel's principal base in Europe for the shuttle service of arms and planes. Eventually, several Dakota transports commuted back and forth between the two nations, ferrying to Israel dismantled fighter planes. They ferried artillery pieces, armored vehicles, and lighter weapons and ammunition. Planes arrived from other countries as well, including bombers and fighters flown illegally by veterans of the Allied air forces out of Britain and the United States. Thousands of tons of ammunition, military equipment, and clothing now arrived, much of it purchased, much of it donated from Jewish sources throughout the world. The French government also supported Israel. Weapons were sold in large quantities to Israel. Training, storage, and assembly facilities were provided near French arms depots and abandoned French Air Force landing strips. Airfields in Corsica were made available to planes refueling en route to Israel. So during the month-long truce, new recruits were given intensive training and new weapons were mastered. Eventually, there were 60,000 men in service and growing quantities of European and American equipment at the Army's disposal. All this, 60,000 men and all the equipment, was systematically transformed into a modern fighting force. All political attempts to squeeze the state out of existence had failed. Now, a military attempt to squeeze the state out of existence had failed as well. And the lesson we learn from that is that God is sovereign. He wanted the state of Israel set up, and every political attempt to shrink and remove the state was thwarted, and now the armies of those who wanted to destroy the state had been brought to a standstill as well. This is the hand of God in the formation of the modern state of Israel. Next, we come to the Israeli offensive. As the truce period approached its ends, the Egyptians prepared to strike the first blow. But on July 8th, before the truce expired, General Naguib renewed the attack against Negba. Remember, Negba was the main cohesive element of Israeli defense in the south. The truce had not expired yet, and General Naguib renewed the attack. But Negba had been reinforced with heavy equipment during the truce, and now it successfully hurled back the repeated Egyptian assaults. After this was successful, the Jewish army itself, the Jewish military themselves, began a limited offense. They reoccupied a number of villages in the northwestern corner of the Negev and forced back the main Egyptian line in the center. It soon became evident to Yigdal Yadin and to his staff that the Egyptians no longer represented a serious offensive threat, and they would be dealt with at a more opportune time. In the north, the Syrians were content to dig in. They dug in at the captured farm settlement of Mishmar HaYarden. The presence, however, of 2,000 Arab irregulars in the lower Galilee mountains was a much more serious threat, and the Jewish army disposed of it in a brutal week-long campaign during which they overran the Arab town of Nazareth and cleared the surrounding Arab villages. Now, at the same time, the principal Israeli military effort was concentrated in the legion-occupied Lida-Ramla area. This area also dominated Israel's major road junctions north, south, east, and west, including the opening of the Jerusalem Corridor and the country's one major airport. So this was a very strategic place to attack. On July 9th, Yigdal alone led two of his brigades in an attack on this Arab strong point. In the course of a day and a night, the enemy positions were completely encircled. On the 11th, Lida and its international airport fell to Lieutenant Colonel Moshe Dayan's mechanized army, mechanized infantry. The following afternoon, Dayan led his column of jeeps into Ramla. He barreled down the main street at full speed with machine guns firing. And by doing that, Dayan's troops sent the legionnaires fleeing. And with this sledgehammer operation, the Jewish army eliminated any remaining Arab threat to Tel Aviv. Well, I see we're coming to the end of our time for this lesson. Why don't we bring lesson number 11 to a close, and we'll pick up lesson number 12 with a discussion of the Arab refugee problem that ensued from the war of 1948.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Hadavar Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Hadavar Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries. If you're listening to this class on audio tape, please turn the tape over to begin the next lesson. If you're listening to this class on CD, the next lesson will begin in a moment.
Going from Egypt up the Gaza Strip, up the coastal road toward north toward Tel Aviv. And the Egyptians encountered unexpectedly stiff resistance from a little isolated kibbutz known as Yad Mordechai. Yad Mordechai withstood 5 days of intensive Egyptian shelling before being evacuated. Those 5 days tied up approximately half of Naguib's coastal force and mauled one of his battalions so thoroughly that it had to be temporarily deactivated. Several miles away, another kibbutz, Negba, was blocking the Egyptian advance with equally ferocious resistance. The Egyptians eventually decided to skirt the farm community, and Negba remained a continual flank threat on the flank. It was bristling with arms. They decided to go around it. The Egyptian, Neguib, moved with elaborate caution, and he slowed his drive 16 miles from the outskirts of Tel Aviv. And it was at this time that Yadin decided to risk a tactical offensive. On May 29th, he ordered reinforcements from the Jerusalem corridor to circle Naguib's positions at night and to attack the Egyptians from the rear. With a troop strength of barely half of that of the invaders, the relief force nevertheless found darkness and surprise very, very effective. The Egyptians were thrown into confusion by the unexpected descent upon their flank. Now, Yadin exploited the disarray by calling a press conference and announcing that the Egyptian supply lines had been cut by overwhelming concentrations of Israeli troops. Now, this news, quote-unquote, this news was immediately dispatched over international wire services and eventually reached Cairo. Yadin had hoped that the Egyptian High Command would accept the story at face value, and they did. They accepted this story at face value. They radioed Naguib to pull up short, and the bewildered commander dutifully followed orders. Naguib's setback proved to be the turning point of the Egyptian invasion. Tel Aviv was never in jeopardy again. The Jewish situation in Jerusalem was very, very serious and precarious. The Jerusalem area was besieged by Transjordan's Arab Legion. The Arabs controlled every high place, every height around the city and within the city. Their fighting strength by then was nearly 4,500 armed men. While the Jewish community, they were numerically equal, but were without weapons. We were virtually without weapons. And so the battle for Jerusalem commenced. On May 19th, Abdullah sent his first units into the old city. Simultaneously, an additional 2,000 legionnaires, well-equipped with artillery, and also commanded by British officers, moved on Jerusalem from the north and soon besieged the outlying perimeter. After 10 days of savage fighting, the outnumbered Jewish troops finally managed to drive the legion back to the point of its furthest advance at Mea Shearim. On May 28th, the British commander, Sir John Glubb, decided to call off the attack in the northern part of the city. Some of his companies had lost half, as much as half their effective strength, and others were unnerved by the shattering blast of homemade Jewish mortars. And from that point on, the Arabs switched their offensive to Jerusalem's southern approaches. On May 2nd, under cover of a heavy Transjordanian artillery bombardment, Egyptian infantrymen stormed the kibbutz of Ramat Rachel, lying astride the entrance to southern Jerusalem. What followed was the single most furious encounter, most furious battle of the war. The little kibbutz changed hands 5 times during the next 4 days. Soldiers pressing forward in bayonet attack often had to climb over bodies piled one on top of the other. But when the last attack was over, it was the Jewish community, most of them former Irgun, most of them former Etzel members, who were in control. And for that moment at least, the imminent possibility of the Arabs capturing the new city had faded. However, the Jewish quarter of the city failed to hold out. On May 28th, the Jewish quarter surrendered. News of the fall of the old city was received with profound shock in the Yishuv. That meant the loss of the Western Wall, and also the loss of the Temple Mount. So the loss of those two very important sites was lamented with bitterness in the years to come. So the Arabs thus far had been unable to conquer the urban complex through direct assault. By the opening of June, however, the ability of the metropolitan area to hold out was far from certain. The prospect of mass starvation was very real. Ben-Gurion insisted that full military priority be given to opening the Jerusalem highway. Remember, this is one of those key highways that had been cut by the Arab forces. Yigdal Alon was called down from the north on May 23rd to assume strategic responsibility for the assault on Latrun. Latrun was an Arab strong point controlling the road. New recruits were needed to augment the Jewish forces. And so hundreds of recent immigrants possessing no military experience, no military training, not even basic training, were rushed up by bus and taxi from Tel Aviv. On May 25th, under the command of Colonel Shlomo Shamir, the attack was launched in a blistering desert calm scene. Blistering desert heat wave. There was no adequate reconnaissance, there was no adequate artillery support, and the soldiers were thrown into a direct frontal offensive. The Arab Legion's 4th Regiment, ensconced on the village heights, raked the attackers with mortars and artillery, and the Jewish soldiers were thrown back with heavy loss of life. During the next few days, additional efforts were mounted, but each time the result was the same. Latrun very nearly became the graveyard of Jewish hopes for breaking the siege of Jerusalem. A single alternative remained for opening up a Jewish supply line. Now, during the previous weeks, Colonel David Marcus, an American Jewish volunteer and West Point graduate, was serving as area commander for the road. He'd been using a path south of Latrun, south of the town of Deir Ayyub, to infiltrate troops on foot through the hills of Jerusalem. The Deir Ayyub section of the road is also known as the Bab al-Wad. Now, Marcus speculated that the path that he used, the path might be widened, just wide enough to enable vehicles to pass through. Those vehicles then could carry supplies and break the siege of Jerusalem. He broached this idea to Yadin, and with Yadin's approval, hundreds of laborers were now summoned from Tel Aviv and immediately put to work clearing boulders and dynamiting rock sidings. Their work was named the Burma Road. There was no opportunity for rest, even in the fiercest heat, for the United Nations truce was to come into effect on June 11th. If the Burma Road was not completed before then, no further efforts would be permitted after the truce deadline, and the result would be that Jerusalem would starve. On June 9th, a primitive roadbed was cut through the Jerusalem mountains, and the first trucks loaded with cans of food and water ventured out on the makeshift highway. And several hours later, they entered Jerusalem, and they were greeted to an enthusiastic and rapturous Jewish population. They just beat the deadline. And now the first United Nations truce is going to go into effect. The idea of a truce in the fighting was introduced and endorsed by the UN Security Council on May 20th. There was a mediator chosen, Count Folke Bernadette of Sweden. This chosen mediator arrived in Israel the following week. Later, he was assassinated by the Stern Gang. The Stern Gang was suspected of the assassination. This was the same group that assassinated Lord Moyne. Now, the Arabs were generally receptive to the idea of a truce. All fighting was designed to stop on June 11th. So this truce descended on the exhausted armies, quote, as dew from heaven, in the words of one Israeli commander. Both sides were at the limit of their resources. Now, strategically, the Arabs had gained very, very little. The Syrians had established a bridgehead on Israeli territory, but it was a minimal one. The Arab Legion from Transjordan had taken the old city, but that was of questionable military importance. The Egyptians had acquired a toehold in the Negev, but that was just a barren desert. Whatever pretense of a united command that had ever existed among the Arab armies had simply disintegrated with the actual fighting, and the Arab armies were in disarray. Abdullah, the Hashemite king of Transjordan, lost interest in continuing the war. However, the other Arab leaders made effective use of the truce. The Iraqis increased their numbers at the front up to 10,000, and they added large quantities of equipment. The Syrians also carried out an extensive recruiting campaign, as well as the Egyptians. By the first week of July, the number of Arab regular troops in Israel had grown from 32,000 to some 45,000. Gravely short of manpower and weapons, the fledgling Israeli army actually was in danger of collapse on nearly every front. By the truce provisions, neither side was permitted to introduce new troops to their armies. Under the truce provisions, Jerusalem would be allowed enough food and water for a month, but nothing more. But the Israeli high command had no intention of abiding by these conditions. Abiding by these conditions was considered suicidal. So convoys of food and medicines were rushed to Jerusalem. Mobilization was continued and increased dramatically in early July. The little armaments factory in the land moved into full production, turning out bullets, grenades, and mortar shells. Weapons were secretly unloaded at coastal sites. By then, the quantity of guns and equipment had become substantial. On May 20th, the Czechoslovakian government turned over an entire military airfield to the Jews. In the following months, this became Israel's principal base in Europe for the shuttle service of arms and planes. Eventually, several Dakota transports commuted back and forth between the two nations, ferrying to Israel dismantled fighter planes. They ferried artillery pieces, armored vehicles, and lighter weapons and ammunition. Planes arrived from other countries as well, including bombers and fighters flown illegally by veterans of the Allied Air Forces out of Britain and the United States. Thousands of tons of ammunition, military equipment, and clothing now arrived, much of it purchased, much of it donated from Jewish sources throughout the world. The French government also supported Israel. Weapons were sold in large quantities to Israel. Training, storage, and assembly facilities were provided near French arms depots and abandoned French Air Force landing strips. Airfields in Corsica were made available to planes refueling en route to Israel. So during the month-long truce, new recruits were given intensive training and new weapons were mastered. Eventually, there were 60,000 men in service and growing quantities of European and American equipment at the Army's disposal. All this, 60,000 men and all the equipment, was systematically transformed into a modern fighting force. All political attempts to squeeze the state out of existence had failed. Now, a military attempt to squeeze the state out of existence had failed as well. And the lesson we learn from that is that God is sovereign. He wanted the state of Israel set up, and every political attempt to shrink and remove the state was thwarted, and now the armies of those who wanted to destroy the state had been brought to a standstill as well. This is the hand of God in the formation of the modern state of Israel. Next, we come to the Israeli offensive. As the truce period approached its ends, the Egyptians prepared to strike the first blow. But on July 8th, before the truce expired, General Naguib renewed the attack against Negba. Remember, Negba was the main cohesive element of Israeli defense in the south. The truce had not expired yet, and General Naguib renewed the attack. But Negba had been reinforced with heavy equipment during the truce, and now it successfully hurled back the repeated Egyptian assaults. After this was successful, the Jewish army itself, the Jewish military themselves, began a limited offense. They reoccupied a number of villages in the northwestern corner of the Negev and forced back the main Egyptian line in the center. It soon became evident to Yigdal Yadin and to his staff that the Egyptians no longer represented a serious offensive threat, and they would be dealt with at a more opportune time. In the north, the Syrians were content to dig in. They dug in at the captured farm settlement of Mishmar HaYarden. The presence, however, of 2,000 Arab irregulars in the lower Galilee mountains was a much more serious threat, and the Jewish army disposed of it in a brutal week-long campaign during which they overran the Arab town of Nazareth and cleared the surrounding Arab villages. Now, at the same time, the principal Israeli military effort was concentrated in the Legion-occupied Lydda-Ramla area. This area also dominated Israel's major road junctions north, south, east, and west, including the opening of the Jerusalem Corridor and the country's one major airport. So this was a very strategic place to attack. On July 9th, Yigdal alone led two of his brigades in an attack on this Arab strong point. In the course of a day and a night, the enemy positions were completely encircled. On the 11th, Lydda and its international airport fell to Lieutenant Colonel Moshe Dayan's mechanized infantry. The following afternoon, Dayan led his column of jeeps into Ramla. He barreled down the main street at full speed with machine guns firing. And by doing that, Dayan's troops sent the legionnaires fleeing. And with this sledgehammer operation, the Jewish army eliminated any remaining Arab threat to Tel Aviv. Well, I see we're coming to the end of our time for this lesson. Why don't we bring lesson number 11 to a close, and we'll pick up lesson number 12 with a discussion of the Arab refugee problem that ensued from the war of 1948.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Hadavar Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Hadavar Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries. If you're listening to this class on audio tape, please turn the tape over to begin the next lesson. If you're listening to this class on CD, the next lesson will begin in a moment.